nurse who had killed four of Maria's siblings from the conviction that she was mercifully returning the children to the arms of God. "Dear little thing," the nurse was overheard saying to Maria, "I have sent four to heaven before you, and shall send you also." Educated in convents, Maria simultaneously pursued the visual arts. She was elected to the Academy of Fine Arts at Florence in 1778, and the life of the church. She was organist for the Monastery of the Visitation. As a young woman in London, the beautiful Maria found herself in the glamorous circles inhabited by the writer James Boswell, the painters Sir Joshua Reynolds and Angelica Kauffman, and the collector Charles Townley. She met and married Richard Causeway, an eccentric, charming, and successful miniaturist. He was, one observer wrote, a well-made little man, who was nevertheless very like a monkey in the face. Flamboyant and ambitious, Causeway won the patronage of the Prince of Wales and held court in elegance in Pall Mall. His new house Causeway fitted up in so picturesque and indeed so princely a style that I regret drawings were not made of each apartment, for many of the rooms were more like scenes of enchantment penciled by a poet's fancy than anything perhaps before displayed in a domestic habitation, wrote the antiquarian John Thomas Smith. Furniture was ornately carved, gilded, and covered in the most costly Genoa velvets. There were ivory cabinets and mosaic tables with the feet of lions and eagles. Huge musical clocks made of tortoiseshell and ormolu ticked away, and screens of old Japan sat atop Persian carpets. The scholar William Howard Adams detailed contemporary assessments of the Causeway milieu, finding that the English man of letters William Hazlitt had written that the couple kept house in style, in a sort of co-partnership of so novel a character as to surprise their new neighbors and furnish wonderment for the table talk of the town. Horace Walpole, the writer and politician, meanwhile, once saw Mademoiselle Le Chevalier d'Eon, known in her day as a transvestite diplomat spy, teaching fencing to the Causeway's guests in the midst of a party. One Causeway friend whom Jefferson got to know, Pierre-François Hugues, was the illustrator of the erotically explicit Monument de la vie privée des douze Césars and Monument du culte secret des dames romaines. In Paris, the late summer of 1786, Hugues and the Causeways met the artist John Trumbull, and through Trumbull they were to make the acquaintance of the American minister to France. Jefferson was in a marvelous mood. He was doing what he loved to do, moving through Paris on a relaxed, high-minded yet practical mission to explore the art of architecture with an eye toward adapting the most brilliant innovations of Europe for America. With Trumbull, Jefferson called on the men who had designed the dome of the Halle aux Blés, the grain market in Paris. The architects Jacques-Guillaume Legrand and Jacques Molinos had built a wood-ribbed dome punctuated with glass. The effect was wondrous, allowing light to pour through the glass sections. Jefferson, who thought it the most superb thing on earth, was eager to learn more. Hence the call on Legrand and Molinos at No. 6, Rue Saint-Florentin, where Jefferson and Trumbull met the Causeways. Maria, 27, enchanted Jefferson, then 43, from the first. She had voluptuous lips, startling violet blue eyes, and fashionably coiffed golden hair. His infatuation with her appears to have been instantaneous. In a way, he disappeared into those eyes and did not emerge for air for nearly a month. Hungry for her company, he put the rest of the world at bay. Engaged to dine that day at the Duchesse de La Rochefoucauld's, Jefferson lied, not very inventively, and sent word to the Duchess that diplomatic dispatches had arrived that required immediate attention. Everyone else in the party joined in the conspiracy. "Every soul of you had an engagement for that day," Jefferson wrote. "Yet all these were to be sacrificed that you might dine together." The day was nearly perfect. Maria spoke many languages, but her English was not particularly fluent, which may have made Jefferson's conversations with her all the more exotic and charming. Jefferson, the Causeways, and Trumbull had dinner together in Saint-Cloud, took in a fireworks display, and called on Johann Baptist Krumpholz, the composer and harpist. At last came the hour for parting. For Jefferson and Maria, however, this was only the opening act in a very brief but intense drama in which Jefferson showed every sign of having fallen in love. Richard Causeway may or may not have noticed, and if he did, it is difficult to say whether he would have cared. Flirtation, if not more, was part of the world in which the Causeways lived, and it was not unknown in Jefferson's. The pursuit of the seemingly unavailable was something he knew from his experience with Betsy Walker. He had done this kind of thing before. The early autumn of 1786, however, was the first time he was able to undertake a romantic adventure with so little risk of censure from the world around him. The most perilous element for Jefferson? That Maria, if James Boswell was to be believed, treated men like dogs. He was willing to risk it. Day after day, as August gave way to September, the two made Paris their own. From Saint-Germain to the Pont de Neuilly, from the hills along the banks of the Seine to a number of elaborate secluded gardens. For Jefferson, every moment was filled with something agreeable. They had a fondness for getaway spots. Bagatelle was a neoclassical domed folly built by the Comte d'Artois, brother of the king. The Désert des Rays was an expansive garden that included a forested apartment built in a fanciful ancient column by François Racine de Montville. How grand the idea excited by the remains of such a column, Jefferson said. The spiral staircase, too, was beautiful. Jefferson and Maria were in a private world. The wheels of time moved on with a rapidity of which those of our carriage gave but a faint idea, he said. And yet, in the evening, when one took a retrospect of the day, what a mass of happiness had we traveled over. Jefferson dislocated his right wrist in this period. He was mysterious about exactly how he had come to be injured. It was by one of those follies from which good cannot come, but ill may, he told William Smith in October 1786. The episode, perhaps a faux heroic leap over a fence, occurred sometime on or shortly before September 18th. Days after the delegates gathered back home for the September 11, 1786, opening of the Annapolis Convention. Writing him as he tried to recover, Maria said, "I only mention my wish I would serve you and help you at dinner and divert your pain after dinner with good music." He was honest about how much his hand hurt. "I have passed the night in so much pain that I have not closed my eyes," Jefferson wrote Maria. "It is with infinite regret, therefore, that I must relinquish your charming company for that of the surgeon, whom I have sent for to examine into the cause of this change. I am in hopes it is only the having rattled a little too freely over the pavement yesterday. If you do not go today, I shall still have the pleasure of seeing you again. If you do, God bless you wherever you go. Let me know if you do not go today." Maria, who was due to leave Paris, replied quickly, "I'm very, very sorry indeed for having been the cause of your pains in the night. You repeatedly insisted it would do you no harm. I felt interested and did not insist. I shall write to you from England. It is impossible to be wanting to a person who has been so excessively obliging. I don't attempt to make compliments. They can be none for you. But I beg you will think us sensible to your kindness, and that it will be with infinite pleasure I shall remember the charming days we have passed together, and shall long for next spring." On October 9th, 1786, came a note from John Trumbull in Antwerp. "Mr. and Mrs. Causeway arrived this morning at 3 o'clock, having rowed all night in the rain." Saying goodbye had been, he told her later, his last sad office. The result was a long, revealing letter dated October 12, 1786. "Seated by my fireside, solitary and sad, the following dialogue took place between my head and my heart," began the more than 4,000-word essay, for it was more an essay than a conventional letter. In it, Jefferson, writing with his left hand, shows himself to be a shrewd student of the human character in general, and of his own in particular. Head. "Well, friend, you seem to be in a pretty trim." Heart. "I am indeed the most wretched of all earthly beings. overwhelmed with grief, every fiber of my frame distended beyond its natural powers to bear. I would willingly meet whatever catastrophe should leave me no more to feel or to fear. Head. These are the eternal consequences of your warmth and precipitation. This is one of the scrapes into which you are ever leading us. You confess your follies, indeed, but still you hug and cherish them, and no reformation can be hoped where there is no repentance. Heart. Oh, my friend, this is no moment to upbraid my foibles. I am rent into fragments by the force of my grief. If you have any balm, pour it into my wounds. If none, do not harrow them by new torments. Spare me in this awful moment. At any other I will attend with patience to your admonitions. Head. On the contrary, I never found that the moment of triumph with you was the moment of attention to my admonitions. While suffering under your follies, you may perhaps be made sensible of them, but the paroxysm over, you fancy it can never return. Harsh, therefore, as the medicine may be, it is my office to administer it. Heart. May heaven abandon me if I do. Head. I wished to make you sensible how imprudent it is to place your affections without reserve on objects you must so soon lose, and whose loss, when it comes, must cost you such severe pangs. Remember the last night. You knew your friends were to leave Paris today. This was enough to throw you into agonies. All night you tossed us from one side of the bed to the other. No sleep, no rest. To avoid these eternal distresses to which you are forever exposing us, you must learn to look forward before you take a step which may interest our peace. Everything in this world is a matter of calculation. Advance then with caution the balance in your hand. Put into one scale the pleasures which any object may offer, but put fairly into the other the pains which are to follow, and see which preponderates. The making of an acquaintance is not a matter of indifference. When a new one is proposed to you, view it all round. Consider what advantages it presents, and to what inconveniences it may expose you. Do not bite at the bait of pleasure till you know there is no hook beneath it. The art of life is the art of avoiding pain, and he is the best pilot who steers clearest of the rocks and shoals with which he is beset. Pleasure is always before us, but misfortune is at our side. While running after that, this arrests us. The most effectual means of being secure against pain is to retire within ourselves, and to suffice for our own happiness. A friend dies or leaves us, we feel as if a limb was cut off. He is sick, we must watch over him and participate of his pains. His fortune is shipwrecked, ours must be laid under contribution. He loses a child, a parent, or a partner, we must mourn the loss as if it was our own. Heart. And what more sublime delight than to mingle tears with one whom the hand of heaven hath smitten? To watch over the bed of sickness, and to beguile its tedious and its painful moments. To share our bread with one to whom misfortune has left none? This world abounds indeed with misery. To lighten its burdens we must divide it with one another. When nature assigned us the same habitation, she gave us over it a divided empire. To you she allotted the field of science, to me that of morals. When the circle is to be squared, or the orbit of a comet to be traced, when the arch of greatest strength or the solid of least resistance is to be investigated, take you the problem. It is yours. Nature has given me no cognizance of it. In like manner, in denying to you the feelings of sympathy, of benevolence, of gratitude, of justice, of love, of friendship, she has excluded you from their control. To these she has adapted the mechanism of the heart. Morals were too essential to the happiness of man to be risked on the uncertain combinations of the head. She laid their foundation, therefore, in sentiment, not in science. That she gave to all as necessary to all. This to a few only, as sufficing with a few. I know indeed that you pretend authority to the sovereign control of our conduct in all its parts, and a respect for your grave saws and maxims, a desire to do what is right, has sometimes induced me to conform to your counsels. If our country, when pressed with wrongs at the point of the bayonet, had been governed by its head instead of its heart, where should we have been now? Hanging on a gallows as high as Haman's. You began to calculate and to compare wealth and numbers. We threw up a few pulsations of our warmest blood. We supplied enthusiasm against wealth and numbers. We put our existence to the hazard when the hazard seemed against us, and we saved our country, justifying at the same time the ways of Providence, whose precept is to do always what is right and leave the issue to Him. In short, my friend, as far as my recollection serves me, I do not know that I ever did a good thing on your suggestion, or a dirty one without it. I do forever, then, disclaim your interference in my province. Fill paper as you please with triangles and squares. Try how many ways you can hang and combine them together. We are not immortal ourselves, my friend. How can we expect our enjoyments to be so? We have no rose without its thorn, no pleasure without alloy. It is the law of our existence, and we must acquiesce. So, which one, the head or the heart? Jefferson gave the heart both the last word and the highest accolade he could bestow when he credited it with victory in the American Revolution. The immediate recipient of the letter was not sure how to react. Your letter could employ me for some time, an hour to consider every word, to every sentence I could write a volume, Maria wrote Jefferson, before lapsing into nonsensical English. They conducted a friendly, if sporadic, correspondence for the rest of their lives. Jefferson's letter represents his most extensive literary attempt to reconcile competing human impulses. His categories of reason versus emotion here are useful, but too tidy. The heart, for instance, can be driven by affection, appetite, or some combination of the two. Were his feelings for Maria rooted in his soul or in his glands? Or, most likely, both. The truth appears to have been murky, even to Jefferson. What is clear is that he was self-aware and prepared to live with unresolved contradictions, approaching the crises of life with a sense of hope, tempered by a recognition that he, at least, was not fated to live to see the end of heartbreak, failure, disappointment, and death. We have no rose without its thorn, no pleasure without alloy, he had written, as the heart, not the head. It is the law of our existence, and we must acquiesce. Jefferson believed that the future could be better than the past. He knew, though, that life was best lived among friends in the pursuit of large causes, understanding that pain was the price for anything worth having. Chapter 21. Do you like our new Constitution? Cherish, therefore, the spirit of our people, and keep alive their attention. Do not be too severe upon their errors, but reclaim them by enlightening them. Thomas Jefferson. Debt-ridden, France faced a supreme test. In the mid-1780s, partly because of its spending on the American Revolution, the Bourbon government of Louis XVI was in a long-term financial crisis, exacerbated by widespread hunger and by anger over the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. Jefferson was shocked by the poverty he saw among ordinary Frenchmen. Patsy always remembered the beggars who surrounded their carriage as they first traveled to Paris. The financial and political difficulties facing the monarchy and the French nation were immense. Taxes were unequal and haphazardly collected. The heaviest burden of the cost of the crown and its expensive ways and wars fell less on nobles or clergy, who were largely exempt, and more on commoners, creating understandable tension and popular hostility. It is impossible to increase taxes, disastrous to keep on borrowing, and inadequate merely to cut expenses, Charles-Alexandre de Calonne, Louis's finance minister told the king in an August 1786 memorandum. At Calonne's urging, the king summoned an assembly of notables, the first in more than a century and a half to consider a plan of reform. "Of course, it calls up all the attention of the people," Jefferson wrote to John Jay in January 1787. Still, Jefferson was no hothead, arguing that dealing with such large problems required a deft hand. "Should they attempt more than the established habits of the people are ripe for, they may lose all and retard infinitely the ultimate object of their aim," Jefferson wrote a friend in March 1787. The assembly of notables failed, leading to calls, including one from the Marquis de Lafayette, for an Estates General, an institution of nobles, clergy, and commoners created in the Middle Ages to advise the monarchy. Its last meeting had been held in 1614. Hope for large-scale reform began to quicken. One member of the liberally-minded club captured the spirit of the hour as the Estates General approached, writing, "We talked about the establishment of a new constitution for the state as if it were an easy job, a natural event." He continued, "In the ecstasy of those days of hopes and celebration, we scarcely cast a glance at the obstacles to be overcome, before laying the first bases of freedom, before establishing the principles rejected by the spirit of the court, the privileged orders, the great corporations, and the old customs." While the French were dealing with an authoritarian state, the Americans had the opposite problem. "The inefficacy of our government becomes daily more and more apparent," John Jay had written Jefferson in October 1786. "Our credit and our treasury are in a sad situation, and it is probable that either the wisdom or the passions of the people will produce changes." Which of the two, the wisdom or the passions, was the question. In New England, a group led by Daniel Shays, a revolutionary veteran, rose up to protest a lack of debt relief. "A spirit of licentiousness has infected Massachusetts," Jay wrote Jefferson. John Adams sought to reassure Jefferson about Shays in November 1786. "Don't be alarmed at the late turbulence in New England," Adams wrote. "The Massachusetts Assembly had, in its zeal to get the better of their debt, laid on a tax, rather heavier than the people could bear. But all will be well, and this commotion will terminate in additional strength to government." Jefferson was relieved. "I can never fear that things will go far wrong where common sense has fair play," he told Adams. Then the inevitable issue. Would Britain use the moment to cause trouble for the United States? Jay wrote Jefferson that there might be Canadian designs on America through an understanding between the insurgents in Massachusetts and some leading persons in Canada. Jay also fretted that Britain could capitalize on an idea that may do mischief, the notion that the interests of the Atlantic and western parts of the United States are distinct, and the growth of the latter tends to diminish that of the former. Writing to a correspondent in America with the expectation that his views would be shared at home, the powerless congressman of 1783 to 1784 was now taking a softer, more sanguine tone about authority and order. There is no question that Jefferson's experience in France gave his politics a more democratic cast than they had had when he left America for Paris. Jefferson wrote, "The basis of our governments being the opinion of the people, the very first object should be to keep that right. And were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. But I should mean that every man should receive those papers and be capable of reading them. Do not be too severe upon the people's errors, but reclaim them by enlightening them. If once they become inattentive to the public affairs, you and I, and Congress, and assemblies, judges, and governors, shall all become wolves. It seems to be the law of our general nature, in spite of individual exceptions, and experience declares that man is the only animal which devours his own kind." Jefferson showed his grasp of politics and his understanding of the nature of both governor and governed in a letter to Madison on Tuesday, January 30th, 1787. There were, he said, three kinds of societies, those without government, as among our Indians, those wherein the will of everyone has a just influence, and those of force, as is the case in all other monarchies and in most of the other republics. It was fine to think of the first as ideal, Jefferson said, but it was impractical where there was any great degree of population. He thus dispensed with an Edenic vision of free men dwelling together without government. The second was where men should focus their attention and their care. The mass of mankind under that enjoys a precious degree of liberty and happiness. It has its evils, too, the principal of which is the turbulence to which it is subject. But weigh this against the oppressions of monarchy, and it becomes nothing. Liberty, he was saying, requires patience, forbearance, and fortitude. Republics were not for the faint-hearted. I hold it that a little rebellion now and then is a good thing, he told Madison, and as necessary in the political world as storms in the physical. Leaving Paris in late February 1787, Jefferson set out alone on a journey through the south of France and the north of Italy. Architecture, painting, sculpture, antiquities, agriculture, the condition of the laboring poor, fill all my moments, he wrote William Short. At Aix-en-Provence, he swooned at the beauty of the countryside, the excellence of the food, the joy of the wine. I am now in the land of corn, wine, oil, and sunshine, he wrote Short. What more can man ask of heaven? If I should happen to die at Paris, I will beg of you to send me here and have me exposed to the sun. I am sure it will bring me to life again. He loved the Roman ruins, the old bridges, the aqueducts, and the Maison Carrée at Nîmes, the first-century Roman temple, which inspired his design of the state capital in Richmond. He was back in Paris on Sunday, June 10th, 1787. The world to which he returned seemed bright. In America, the Constitutional Convention had begun in May. Following the action in Philadelphia as closely as he could, Jefferson was skeptical of a proposal to give the federal Congress the authority to veto any individual act a state legislature that concerned national affairs. Knowing human nature, and knowing the Congress, which was human nature writ large, he understood that the Congress would not be able to keep themselves from abusing their power by deciding that everything concerned the national interest. On Tuesday, June 26, 1787, Polly Jefferson, age 8, arrived in London. Handed over to the care of Abigail Adams, Polly did not want to part with the man who had commanded the ship on which she had traveled, a man named Ramsay, and Captain Ramsay did not want to part with Sally Hemings. The old nurse, whom you expected to have attended her, was sick and unable to come, Abigail Adams wrote Jefferson. She has a girl about 15 or 16 with her, the sister of the servant you have with you. There are no known images of Sally Hemings. From what little evidence we have, the 14-year-old Sally, who accompanied Polly Jefferson into the Adams's London house, appeared nearly white and was very handsome, with long, straight hair down her back. There may have been some resemblance, more and less pronounced as the years went on, to the Wales side of the family, which is to say, Sally could well have shared some characteristics with her late half-sister, Mrs. Thomas Jefferson. It is also possible that around 14, Sally Hemings was well-developed. Abigail Adams guessed she was a year or two older than she was. We know, too, that Captain Ramsay was hoping to take an unchaperoned Hemings back across the Atlantic with him, and it seems safe to assume he was not chiefly interested in her conversation. It is a reasonable surmise that Sally Hemings, who arrived in Europe in the summer of 1787, was physically desirable. Polly, it emerged, was a bright child, capable of uncomfortable candor. In London she sobbed when taken from Ramsay, who had become a familiar and probably fond figure during the voyage. Mrs. Adams tried to calm her by invoking the girl's sister Patsy. "I tell her that I did not see her sister cry once," Mrs. Adams wrote Jefferson. She replies that her sister was older and ought to do better. Besides, she had her papa with her. Mrs. Adams then told Jefferson, "I show her your picture. She says she cannot know it. How should she, when she should not know you? Jefferson, Mrs. Adams said, should come fetch his younger daughter and perhaps bring Patsy along, for that might reconcile her little sister to the thoughts of taking a journey. At the end of the day, Abigail reported, Miss Polly has wiped her eyes and laid down to sleep. A night of rest did wonders for the little girl. On Wednesday the 27th, she was, Abigail said, as contented as she was miserable yesterday. She is indeed a fine child. Mrs. Adams was less sure about Sally, who seems to have flummoxed her. The girl who is with Polly is quite a child, and Captain Ramsay is of the opinion will be of so little service that he had better carry her back with him. But of this you will be the judge. She seems fond of the child and appears good-natured. Jefferson thanked Abigail profusely on Sunday, July 1st, 1787, dispatching his French maître d'hôtel, Andréan Petit, to fetch Polly and Sally. He claimed that the crush of work, the arrearages of 3 or 4 months all crowded on me at once, as he put it, kept him from coming personally. In London, Polly was beside herself when she realized her father had delegated the duty of collecting her. Crying and thrown into all her former distresses, Polly clung to Abigail, who wrote Jefferson, "She told me this morning that as she had left all her friends in Virginia to come over the ocean to see you, she did think you would have taken the pains to come here for her, and not have sent a man whom she cannot understand." Lest Jefferson think Abigail was being too rough on him, she added, "I express her own words." Polly Jefferson and Sally Hemings arrived in Paris on Sunday, July 15, 1787. "She had totally forgotten her sister," Jefferson wrote, "but thought, on seeing me, that she recollected something of me, reversing the impression she had given Abigail Adams in London." With Polly safely in hand, Jefferson sat down to thank his sister-in-law for all she and her husband had done for his little girl. "Her reading, her writing, her manners in general show what everlasting obligations we are all under to you," Jefferson wrote Elizabeth Epps. "As far as her affections can be a requital, she renders you the debt, for it is impossible for a child to prove a more sincere affection to an absent person than she does to you." Thinking of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, Jefferson warmly wrote John Adams, "It is really an assembly of demigods." One of the demigods, James Madison, was fretful. "Nothing can exceed the universal anxiety for the event of the meeting here," Madison wrote Jefferson. "Virginia was particularly unsettled. The people are said to be generally discontented. Things had not yet gone as far as they did in Massachusetts, but a drought had wrecked the corn crop, and taxes are another source of discontent. Several prisons, courthouses, and clerks' offices had been willfully burnt. A fear of Jefferson's, one made all the stronger the more time he spent in proximity to the court of Louis XVI, was that the United States might tack toward hereditary power up to and including the installation of a monarch. Such rumors were in the air. The report of an intention on the part of America to apply for a sovereign of the House of Hanover has circulated here, and should an application of that nature be made, it will require a very nice consideration in what manner so important a subject should be treated," Lord Sidney wrote Lord Dorchester from London on Friday, September 14, 1787. Alexander Hamilton was said to believe the most plausible shape of a reunion with Great Britain would be the establishment of a son of the present monarch, with a family compact. Dorchester reported the failure of all such enterprises, sending London a report in 1788 saying that an alleged plan of Hamilton's that had in view the establishment of a monarchy and placing the crown upon the head of a foreign prince was overruled, although supported by some of the ablest members of the convention. In the year of the Constitutional Convention, a British agent, probably George Beckwith, sent word of nascent American royalism to the British Foreign Secretary in London. "At this moment there is not a gentleman in the states between New Hampshire and Georgia who does not view the present government with contempt, who is not convinced of its inefficacy, and who is not desirous of changing it for a monarchy." The letter continued, "They are divided into three classes, The first class proposes a federal government somewhat resembling the Constitution of the State of New York, with an annual executive, Senate, and House of Assembly. The second wished to have a sovereign for life, with two triennial houses of Parliament. The third are desirous of establishing an hereditary monarchy with a form of government as nearly resembling Great Britain as possible. Of the first class, many look up to General Washington. Those of the second and third classes cast their eyes to the House of Hanover for a sovereign. They wish for one of the king's sons. The third class is the most powerful and is composed of some of the most ablest men in the states. From other sources of information, it is understood that men of ability in the states are in general strongly impressed with the necessity of establishing a monarchy. They find their present government neither efficient nor respectable. They are greatly divided in opinion on this subject. Whether they shall raise an American to this dignity, or procure a sovereign from Great Britain, or from France. Fearful of royal control, Jefferson nevertheless remained interested in strength, without which there could be no liberty. In 1787 he watched a crisis in the United Netherlands that he believed instructive for the United States. In a conflict between the Stadtholder, backed by England, and a Patriot Party, backed by France, the Stadtholder prevailed when Frederick William II of Prussia intervened against the Patriots and France failed to honor its commitments. It conveys to us the important lesson that no circumstances of morality, honor, interest, or engagement are sufficient to authorize a secure reliance on any nation, at all times and in all positions, Jefferson wrote Jay in November 1787. To Jefferson, a nation that was to stand among the powers of the earth had to do so on its own. Alliances were always chancy. "We are, therefore, never safe till our magazines are filled with arms," he wrote Jay. On the day after the Constitutional Convention ended in Philadelphia, George Washington dispatched a copy of the draft Constitution to Jefferson in Paris. Benjamin Franklin sent one along, too, and letters about the Constitution flowed into Jefferson's Hôtel de Langeac. After reading a copy of the draft, John Adams told Jefferson that he thought it seems to be admirably calculated to preserve the Union, to increase affection, and to bring us all to the same mode of thinking. Adams asked Jefferson, "What think you of a Declaration of Rights? Should not such a thing have preceded the model?" Jefferson believed so. On first reading the document, he reacted badly. "How do you like our new Constitution?" he wrote Adams. "I confess there are things in it which stagger all my dispositions to subscribe to what such an assembly has proposed." The details of the presidency troubled him. "He may be re-elected from 4 years to 4 years for life," Jefferson said. Reason and experience proved to us that a chief magistrate so continuable is an officer for life. When one or two generations shall have proved that this is an office for life, it becomes on every succession worthy of intrigue, of bribery, of force, and even of foreign interference. He blamed the British for features he did not like, arguing that the British press had exaggerated American instability for so long that the world has at length believed them. The English nation has believed them, the ministers themselves have come to believe them, and what is more wonderful, we have believed them ourselves. Jefferson continued, "We have had 13 states independent 11 years. There has been one rebellion in Massachusetts. That comes to one rebellion in a century and a half for each state. What country before ever existed a century and a half without a rebellion? And what country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? Let them take arms. The remedy is to set them right as to facts, pardon and pacify them. What signify a few lives lost in a century or two? The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure. Our convention has been too much impressed by the insurrection in Massachusetts." Jefferson acknowledged he was being hyperbolic. "The want of facts worth communicating to you has occasioned me to give a little loose to dissertation. We must be contented to amuse when we cannot inform." to Madison on Thursday, December 20, 1787. He reacted to the Constitution in specific terms. Jefferson liked the division of powers into executive, legislative, and judicial branches, and he was impressed that the federal government would have sufficient autonomy and power to be effective, without needing continual recurrence to the state legislatures. He was pleased, too, by the power given to the legislature to levy taxes, and for that reason solely approve of the greater house being chosen by the people directly. Jefferson did not like the omission of a declaration or bill of rights to guarantee freedom of religion, freedom of the press, protection against standing armies, restriction against monopolies, the eternal and unremitting force of the habeas corpus laws, and trials by jury. He allowed that such matters could be addressed by future amendment or by the calling of a new convention. In the end, he was prepared to accept the verdict of the ratifying process. "After all, it is my principle that the will of the majority should always prevail," he told Madison. "If they approve the proposed convention in all its parts, I shall concur in it cheerfully, in hopes that they will amend it whenever they shall find it work wrong." Yet the more he thought about it, the more he hoped that the rights issue could be resolved before the new government was formed. Jefferson suggested that the first 9 states ratify the Constitution, but the remaining 4 states reject it until a declaration of individual rights could be added. Jefferson decided to make his peace with the Constitution as drafted. "There are indeed some faults which revolted me a good deal in the first moment, but we must be contented to travel on towards perfection step by step," he wrote in May 1788. This was a key element of Jefferson's vision. He wrote beautifully of the pursuit of the perfect, but he knew good when he saw it. He would not make the two enemies. Jefferson followed the politics of ratification with precision and passion. Seeking news from each state convention, he kept careful records of vote tallies. In May 1788, he believed the outcome certain. "It is very possible that the President and new Congress may be sitting at New York in the month of September," he said on May 15th. The significance of the presidency was clear to Jefferson from the beginning. Writing of George Washington, James Monroe told Jefferson, "Having commenced again on the public theater, the course which Washington takes becomes not only highly interesting to him, but likewise so to us. The human character is not perfect, and if he partakes of those qualities which we have too much reason to believe are almost inseparable from the frail nature of our being, the people of America will perhaps be lost." So much depended on a single man. Arriving home in Paris after a European journey in April 1788, Jefferson glimpsed Maria Causeway's handwriting in his pile of letters. He opened her note before any other and replied to her before reading his other mail. He had, he said, dreamed of her on his trip. "At Heidelberg, I wished for you. In fact, I led you by the hand through the whole garden," he wrote. "You must now write me a letter teeming with affection, such as I feel for you." He shared a joke with her about the connection between noses and phalluses from Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, a fairly standard flirtatious allusion. One suspects, though, that on the road, Sally Hemings may have also figured in his imagination. In Dusseldorf, Jefferson was fascinated by a 1699 painting of Abraham taking the young servant Hagar to his bed, an image by the Dutch artist Adrian van der Werf. "The picture," Jefferson said, "was delicious." "I would have agreed to have been Abraham, though the consequences would have been that I should have been dead 5,000 or 6,000 years. In May 1788, back at the Hôtel de Langeac, he wrote a friend, "Paris is now become a furnace of politics. All the world is run politically mad. Men, women, children talk of nothing else." Chapter 22. A Treaty in Paris. "He desired to bring my mother back to Virginia with him, but she demurred." Madison Hemings. The years 1788 and 1789 were a time of cascading events in Jefferson's public and private lives. In Holland, there were difficult financial negotiations. In France, there was the rush of revolution. And within the walls of the Hôtel de Langeac, there was Sally Hemings. The French impulse for liberty, both in its laws against slavery and in the revolution against Louis XVI, tested Jefferson personally and politically in 1788 and 1789, threatening him in the most intimate of spheres and forcing him to confront the full implications of his philosophical creed. In this tempestuous time, Jefferson apparently began a sexual relationship with his late wife's enslaved half-sister. Since her arrival with Polly in the summer of 1787, Hemings had been paid some small wages, 12 livres a month for 10 months. Jefferson had bought clothing for her and had her inoculated against smallpox. Her brother James was trained as a chef. Sally's day-to-day routine is less clear, though she may have served the Jefferson daughters as a maid at the convent school during part of her time in Paris. Jefferson could hardly have been leading a more complicated life. His work was urgent, his life in Parisian intellectual and social circles busy and dizzying. He was trying to raise his two daughters. He feared for his young, vulnerable republic, and he had been engaged in a flirtation with a married woman, slipping in and out of hired carriages in the shaded suburbs of Paris and strolling through the romantic forests of the city. From Versailles to the city's theaters and opera, he was living vibrantly and fretting constantly. Any hour could bring devastating news about America, about her security, her stability, her standing. There, in the midst of the swirl and the storms, was a beautiful young woman at his command, a woman who may have reminded him of her half-sister, his wife. The emotional content of the Jefferson-Hemings relationship is a mystery. He may have loved her, and she him. It could have been, as some have argued, coercive, institutionalized rape. She might have just been doing what she had to do to survive an evil system, accepting sexual duty as an element of her enslavement, and using what leverage she had to improve the lot of her children. Or each of these things may have been true at different times. Sex, Jefferson himself once remarked, was the strongest of the human passions, and he was not a man to deny himself what he wanted. Sally Hemings, for her part, was light-colored and decidedly good-looking, Jefferson's grandson Thomas Jefferson Randolph recalled. In following years, Jefferson was always at Monticello at the time she was likely to have conceived the children she is known to have borne. What little evidence we have strongly suggests that Sally Hemings was an intelligent, brave woman who did as much as she could with what little the world had given her. She began this phase of her life as she apparently intended to carry on, with strength and an instinct for survival. For in this opening hour, geography and culture, those things that had conspired to enslave her, were on her side. In France, enslaved persons could apply for their liberty and be granted it, and there was nothing their masters could do about it. Jefferson knew this well. As the American minister, he had once advised a fellow slave owner on the system, and Sally Hemings was no lonely slave girl in Europe. Her big brother James was there with her at the Hôtel de Langeac and could have helped her win her freedom. According to their son Madison Hemings' later account, Sally, who had become Mr. Jefferson's concubine, was pregnant when Jefferson was preparing to return to the United States. "He desired to bring my mother back to Virginia with him, but she demurred," Madison Hemings said. To demur was to refuse, and Jefferson was unaccustomed to encountering resistance to his absolute will at all, much less from a slave. His whole life was about controlling as many of the world's variables as he could. Yet here was a girl, basically the same age as his own eldest daughter, refusing to take her docile part in the long-running drama of the sexual domination of enslaved women by their white masters. She was just beginning to understand the French language well, and in France she was free, while if she returned to Virginia she would be re-enslaved, said Madison Hemings. So she refused to return with him. It was an extraordinary moment. Fresh from arranging terms with the bankers of Europe over a debt that was threatening the foundation of the French nation, Thomas Jefferson found himself in negotiations with a pregnant, enslaved teenager, who, in a reversal of fortune hardly likely to be repeated, had the means at hand to free herself. She, not he, was in control. It must have seemed surreal, unthinkable, even absurd. For the first time in his life, perhaps, Jefferson was truly in a position of weakness at a moment that mattered to him. So he began making concessions to convince Sally Hemings to come home to Virginia. To induce her to do so, he promised her extraordinary privileges and made a solemn pledge that her children should be freed at the age of 21 years, Madison Hemings said. Sally Hemings agreed. In consequence of his promise, on which she implicitly relied, she returned with him to Virginia, said Madison Hemings. Soon after their arrival, she gave birth to a child, of whom Thomas Jefferson was the father. It lived but a short time. She gave birth to 4 others, and Jefferson was the father of all of them. Their names were Beverly, Harriet, Madison, myself, and Eston, 3 sons and 1 daughter. Their father kept the promise he had made to Sally in Paris. "We all became free, agreeable to the treaty entered into by our parents before we were born," Madison Hemings said. It was one of the most important pacts of Jefferson's life. In Paris, the Assembly of Notables had given way to the calling of the Estates General for May 1789. "I imagine you have heard terrible stories of the internal confusions of this country," Jefferson wrote a correspondent in July 1788. "These things swell as they go on. As yet the tumults have not cost a single life, according to the most sober testimony I have been able to collect." He would not be able to say this much longer. On the diplomatic front, the American failure to pay its European debts, chiefly its debt to France, which was one of the many reasons the Royal Treasury was in such trouble, was problematic for Jefferson and Adams. In early 1788, the two men met in Amsterdam for sessions with Dutch bankers. Among Jefferson's concerns was finding capital enough to repay French officers for their services to America during the Revolution, and to ensure that there was money to support the American diplomatic establishments in Europe. He and Adams accomplished both ends in 1788. As confidence in American stability grew, so did America's credit in European markets. Jefferson, a man with large personal debts, deplored the weakness that came with weighty borrowing. "I am anxious about everything which may affect our credit," he wrote Washington in May 1788. "My wish would be to possess it in the highest degree, but to use it little." With deftness, Jefferson also negotiated the first treaty to be ratified under the new Constitution, a consular convention with France that defined diplomatic relations between the two nations. The initial version of this convention, negotiated by Franklin in 1784, was rejected by the Congress for being too accommodating to the French. Jefferson re-entered the fray, saying that he took as his guide the principle that, "instead of declining every article which will be useless to us, we accede to every one which will not be inconvenient." It was a practical way of executing a delicate duty. Under the convention as ratified, the United States was seen and treated as a stronger, more sophisticated, more respected force in the world. Jefferson had done his work well. American politics under the Constitution fascinated him. Washington was to be president, Madison told him. John Hancock and John Adams were talked of principally for vice president. Mr. Jay or John Knox would, I believe, be preferred to either, but both of them will probably choose to remain where they are, said Madison. It is impossible to say which of the former would be preferred or what other candidates may be brought forward. The speculation was irresistible. "It is doubtful who will be vice president," Jefferson wrote a correspondent in August 1788. "The age of Dr. Franklin, and the doubt whether he would accept it, are the only circumstances that admit a question but that he would be the man. Jay Adams, Hancock, Jay, Madison, Rutledge will be all voted for." The maneuvering became more pronounced as the October days passed. Given Washington's Virginia roots, the choice for vice president, Madison reported, lay between Hancock and Adams. For Madison, the two-man field left much to be desired. Hancock is weak, ambitious, a courtier of popularity given to low intrigue. Jay Adams has made himself obnoxious to many, particularly in the southern states, by the political principles avowed in his book. Jefferson watched it avidly. There was, he said, in November 1788, an ill understanding between Mr. Adams and Mr. Hancock. Both proposed as vice presidents. Always there were whispers about monarchy. Supporters of a strong national government, who had been utterly averse to royalty, began to imagine that hardly anything but a king could cure the evil, Washington aide David Humphreys told Jefferson. It was truly astonishing to have been witness to some conversations which I have heard. Jefferson wanted to come home, at least for a while, and he was especially interested in establishing personal contact with Washington. To be on the scene in America had its political uses, for he hated the thought that things were said of him behind his back, a subject of annoyance his friend Francis Hopkinson touched on in a letter from Philadelphia in December 1788. By the by, you have been often dished up to me as a strong anti-federalist, which is almost equivalent to what a Tory was in the days of the war. Jefferson took the occasion to attack the spirit of faction. I am not a federalist, because I never submitted the whole system of my opinions to the creed of any party of men whatever, in religion, in philosophy, in politics, or in anything else where I was capable of thinking for myself, Jefferson replied to Hopkinson in March 1789. Such an addiction is the last degradation of a free and moral agent. If I could not go to heaven but with a party, I would not go there at all. Therefore, I protest to you, I am not of the party of Federalists. But I am much farther from that of the anti-Federalists. Reiterating his positions, he said, My great wish is to go on in a strict but silent performance of my duty, to avoid attracting notice and to keep my name out of newspapers, because I find the pain of a little censure, even when it is unfounded, is more acute than the pleasure of much praise. From America, Madison archly reported John Adams' failed attempt to coin a grand title for the president. Jay Adams espoused the cause of titles with great earnestness. The projected title was His Highness the President of the United States and Protector of Their Liberties. Had the project succeeded, it would have subjected the president to a severe dilemma and given a deep wound to our infant government. Jefferson called Adams's proposal the most superlatively ridiculous thing I ever heard of. It is a proof the more of the justice of the character given by Dr. Franklin of my friend. Always an honest man. Often a great one, but sometimes absolutely mad. It was a brutally cold winter in France, but Jefferson was cheerful. Our new constitution has succeeded beyond what I apprehended it would have done, he wrote in January 1789. Whether something similar might one day be said of the French was a live, explosive question. The cold winter of 1788-89, a scarcity of bread and general political unease, made for a potent mix. As the Estates General met in May 1789, riots in Paris killed about 100 people. Beginning a pattern that persisted, Jefferson interpreted the violence in the most benign light possible, arguing that the episode was unconnected to the larger national questions. In the first week of June, Jefferson had sketched a charter of rights for the French and sent it to the Marquis de Lafayette. Jefferson's draft was minutely practical. There was no rhetoric about human liberty, no rigorous listing of rights to free speech and the like. It was, rather, a document about process and the workings of power. Laws shall be made by the Estates General only, with the consent of the king, for example. And the military shall be subordinate to the civil authority. He wrote it in a hurry, caught up in the drama of the hour, and engaged by its possibilities. On Wednesday, June 17, 1789, the frustrated Third Estate of Commoners successfully designated itself the National Assembly, effectively igniting what history calls the French Revolution. Reacting to centuries of royal absolutism and popular powerlessness, embarking on an odyssey that would lead to successive attempts at republican government, the murders of the king and queen, the institution of a reign of terror, and finally, the establishment of a dictatorial empire under Napoleon Bonaparte, the French would spend the next quarter century struggling to find their way into modernity. It was a struggle with concrete implications not only for France, but for the world, not least for the United States, the nation it had helped bring into being, and for its leaders, including the American minister living at the Hôtel de Langeac, Thomas Jefferson. The unrest in Paris struck home for Jefferson. His house was robbed 3 times. He monitored a street battle between mobs of Parisians and German cavalry at the Place Louis XV that began with the people hurling stones and ended with considerable firing from the mercenary troops. On the night of Tuesday, July 14th, 1789, he was at his friend Madame de Corny's when he learned of the storming of the Bastille. As he reported 2 days later, the tumults in Paris which took place on the change of the ministry, the slaughter of the people and the assault of the Bastille, the beheading of the governor and the lieutenant governor of it, and the Prévost de Marchand, excited in the king so much concern that he went to the Estates General promising to disperse the troops and pledging to reform to restore peace and happiness to his people. The next act remained uncertain. The heat of this city is as yet too great to give entire credit to this, and they continue to arm and organize the bourgeoisie. By the following day, the 17th, Jefferson was telling Thomas Paine that a more dangerous scene of war I never saw in America than what Paris has presented for 5 days past. He confronted the prevailing terror with grace. Writing Maria Causeway, he said that, "Here, in the midst of tumult and violence, the cutting off heads is become so much à la mode that one is apt to feel of a morning whether their own is on their shoulders." On Tuesday, August 25th, 1789, Lafayette asked Jefferson to break every engagement to give us a dinner tomorrow, Wednesday. "We shall be some members of the National Assembly, 8 of us whom I want to coalesce as being the only means to prevent a total dissolution and a civil war." The next day, the National Assembly adopted the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, written by Lafayette. This century